Good day, and welcome to the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Director Phil Keith. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank everyone for joining us today. I call the President's Commission on Law Enforcement and the Administration of Justice to order. And on behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank you for joining us today for this important Commission teleconference meeting. This is our second call of the week and our last panel on reentry. At this time, I'll ask our Executive Director, Dean Keeter, to conduct our roll call of commissioners.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I call the roll, just like to remind everybody that today's event is open to the press. And for any members of the media on the call, if you have questions or need clarification on anything, please don't hesitate to contact Christina Mastropasqua in the Justice Department's Office of Public Affairs. And with that, I'll begin the roll call. Commissioner Bowditch. Commissioner Clemens. Commissioner Evans.
Here.
Commissioner Frazier. Commissioner Galtieri.
I'm here.
Commissioner Hawkins.
Present, thank you.
Commissioner Lombardo. Commissioner McDonald.
Present.
Commissioner Moody.
I'm here.
Commissioner Parr.
Present.
Commissioner Price.
Good afternoon, I'm here.
Commissioner Ramsey.
Here.
Commissioner Rausch.
I'm here.
Commissioner Samaniego.
I'm here.
Commissioner Smallwood.
I'm here.
Vice Chair Sullivan.
Here.
And Commissioner Washington.
Here.
Commissioner Clemens is on also.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, that concludes the roll call.
Thank you. Any other announcements, Dean?
Yes, sir. Today, I'd just like to remind the commissioners and witnesses that your phones and mics are open at all times, so please be mindful of that. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we are good to go.
Thank you. Today, the commission will complete the testimony on the topic of reentry, and then we'll shift our focus tomorrow on a panel on grant funding and processes. All the commissioners should have the bios and testimony for this panel. And as a reminder, we will be posting all these materials on the Law Enforcement Commission website. Once again, we'd be remiss if we did not acknowledge all the commissioners and working group members for making substantial sacrifices to meet the demands of this commission's work. On behalf of Attorney General Barr, we thank each of you. As noted on previous calls, we encourage commissioners to take notes during the testimony of the panelists, and we will then open for questions after the last witness. Our first distinguished panelist is Mr. Tim Johnson, a 9-year veteran with the NFL and the founder and president of the Orlando Serve Foundation. Mr. Johnson, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Director Keith. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, Vice Chair Sullivan, and all the commissioners for this critical work that you're doing. I really appreciate having the opportunity for a few moments to share. As you mentioned, Director Keith, my name is Tim Johnson, and I am the president of the Orlando Serve Foundation, which was founded in 2016 as a neutral convener of 120 organizations across three counties, all coming together to connect the community with resources to provide systems of care to individuals and families in the Central Florida area, those that are living in the woods and shelters and vulnerable places. So after doing that for a couple of years, we began to narrow our focus pretty strategically to the greatest need that we kept running up against, and that is the legal issues that so many of our guests were experiencing. And I want to just move right into the recommendations for this time that I have, without going into details on a lot of other things. the four recommendations that we have for reentry is from a pilot program that we actually did in 2018. And there's four parts to it. There's a pre-release orientation. There's ID assistance for trustee population. And the third part is court hearings for court cost fines and fines, fees, and conversion to new payment plans or retrieval from collection agencies. And then the fourth part is community and work release program supervised offenders. The first part of that is all the individuals that are short timers that are about to be released will get information regarding assistance with their identification by being referred to a community center where we hold our events from the macro in the stadium to now local in communities, and they're able to get educated, screened, and scheduled for court hearings if they qualify, if it's appropriate to address the fines, fees, and court costs that they have to establish a new payment plan or do the community service with the assistance for the trustees. It's where we will go to the actual jail and have them – actually, excuse me. The second part is where the trustees are vetted by the COs. The correction officers will do a vetting and a screening for individuals that qualify, and attorneys will go in and then work with them while they're still in jail. And the third part is that we actually hold in the BRC an actual hearing to provide orders for the offender to either have a new payment plan or begin to prepare for the community service so that as they come out of incarceration, they can seamlessly be identified in the community with legitimate identification. And then also with the work release program, those are being supervised, have a chance to come to our community event as well. And so what we've seen is in this pilot program, a real impact in the lives of those who have a lot of other resources, but they don't have that identification, which legitimizes them. They have food, they have maybe opportunities, but when it comes to driving privileges, employment, obtaining housing, other necessary documents that so many of us are able to take for granted, these individuals are really struggling, and then we see the return back to that place of incarceration. And so there's a lot that we want to do with this over time, but our concern has been capacity. And so with that, I'll just stop and make myself available to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your testimony and certainly your commitment to service. Next, we welcome Assistant Commissioner Jay Sanders of the Georgia Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. Commissioner Sanders, thank you for joining us today, and you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, and to Vice Chairman Solomon and the other commissioners that are on the line. My name is Jay Sanders. I'm Assistant Commissioner, actually, of the Georgia Department of Corrections. I'm also a member of the Georgia Criminal Justice Coordinating Council. But I wanted to hit my recommendations real quick and then put a little meat on the bones, as it were, for some things that we have done in Georgia over the last few years. So some of the recommendations that we have kind of go in line with what Mr. Johnson was just saying, looking at additional funding and staff education across the board to make sure that no inmate is released without having completed their prescribed behavioral and educational programming while incarcerated, give them that leg up. Second recommendation would be funding and training in the area to ensure there's a warm handoff from the correctional facility back to the community, whether it be a physical health provider, a mental health provider, the community supervision provider, probation or parole, as it were, in your respective jurisdictions. Additional funding, recommendation number three, additional funding and cooperative agreements among state and federal agencies in the very areas that Mr. Johnson was just talking about, personal identification and documents. We've done some great things in Georgia on that, and I'll touch on those in just a second. And then one of the biggest things that we've seen here in some of our facilities is educating and changing the culture of our staff. Corrections is a long-time business. It's been around a long time. I know in Georgia we see third and fourth generation correctional staff, but we've got to look at how we do business and how we deal with those that are in our custody. Real quick, a snapshot of Georgia. Back in 2009, Pew Report, 1 in 31, many of you may remember that. Georgia was 1 in 13 under supervision, while the national average was 1 in 31. Our system overview, we're the 8th largest state in the nation, but we're the 4th largest state in prison population. We currently, when you add in our probation alternatives, we have about 56 to 57,000 individuals in custody. We release and admit some 17 to 18,000 inmates per year. We have a $1.2 billion budget with about 11,000 employees, about 90 facilities. We know that most individuals will get out of prison at some point in time. You hear different statistics, 95, 96, 97, 98%, depending on how you look at it. But we know that most people will be getting out. So we've got to look at the factors that influence that. We've got to keep them off of those same playgrounds that they were on when they came to us, those environments, I mean, the economics, the lifestyle, the thinking patterns, coupled with mental health that many of them have, substance abuse issues. Those are the areas that we've tried to address. We took a heavy look over the last 6 to 8 years through our Criminal Justice Reform Council at how we did business, both in the correction system as well as probation, parole, and a number of other areas. So these are some things that came out of that. One, we developed a risk needs assessment that's automated. It's an in-house assessment that is normed on our population. And we use that to, like I said, look at their risk, but also their needs. What do they need? We use those central 8 criminogenic needs that Andrew and Bonta use, substance abuse, criminal thinking, peer associates, family, education, employment, mental health, trauma, et cetera. Those are what we look at to determine, all right, what do we need to address while this individual is in our custody, be it for 2 years or 20 years? And then we do a triage. And we do put them into programming as quickly as possible. We try to program those that are getting out that are the highest risk, highest needs. Obviously, like everybody else, our treatment dollars are limited. So we try to focus on those that have the highest risk, highest need. Evidence-based programming. We will not offer programming in the Department of Corrections unless we have research to show empirically that programming is positive and will benefit those that are in our custody. We've taken two facilities and turned them into evidence-based prisons where we've created a holistic approach to dealing with the individuals. Other programming, educational, vocational. Currently, our recidivism rate is about 27.6%. That's based on our fiscal year 16 releases. Those that go through our cognitive programs, about 24%. GED programs, 19%, and vocational programming is about 18.6%. So we know that if we can get those folks through these programs, the chances of seeing them again are fewer. We've pushed very heavily over the last few years to offer GEDs in our facilities. Since FY18, we've successfully graduated almost 12,000 inmates with a GED. And over 300 inmates with charter school diplomas through a partnership with a local charter school system. We partner with the technical college systems to offer vocational trainings and have had over 57,000 in the last 5 fiscal year, 57,000 vocational OJT, post-secondary, and job skills completions. We have reentry assessment centers. These are Chromebooks with whitelisted websites where our inmates can sit down and they can look at housing, employment. They can work on resumes and interviewing skills prior to release. So we're trying to use some technology there, especially some of these individuals have been in long enough that technology's changed dramatically. Reentry documents. I want to hit this one real quick. Mr. Johnson talked about that. That has been a huge focus for us over the last few years. We begin the process with the birth certificate. We've created an agreement with Vital Records where we actually have staff that are embedded in Vital Records, and all they do is pull inmate birth certificates for those that are born in Georgia. So that's the basis and starts that document for us. Since inception, we've generated over 40,000 birth certificates for Georgia-born inmates. Social Security card, we've worked out an MOU with Social Security Administration where we try our best to have a Social Security card for every inmate that can prior to their release. The biggest one for us most recently has been working with our Department of Driver Services, where an inmate can get either a license if they're eligible or a state identification card. And that's a state ID, not an inmate ID. So they leave with something that says State of Georgia, not Department of Corrections. Last year, we obtained over 3,300 driver's licenses and over 5,300 IDs and have done over 20,000 since inception. We also have a number of other documents that we put together. And we put all these in a central repository, and about 6 months before they're released, we ship this information to the facility where the inmate will be releasing from so it can be put in their hand the day they walk out. We also have the Metro Reentry Facility. Warden Perkins is on, and he's going to talk about that, so I will not go into that as well. We've also worked very hard in the areas of housing as well as health, both physical health and mental health, to make sure individuals have the medications they need and place to stay when they get out. Like I said, I don't want to take up much more of time, and I've got a busy panel. Thank you for allowing us to present today, and we're open and subject to questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Sanders, for your valued testimony and certainly your service. Our next distinguished panelist is Warden Stephen Perkins, who is the warden at the Georgia Department of Corrections Metro Reentry Facility. Thank you for joining us today, Warden Perkins. You're recognized.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you to the panel for hearing us out today. Again, my name is Warden Stephen Perkins, and I'm with the Georgia Department of Corrections. I am the warden of Metro Reentry and Metro Atlanta Complex. My recommendations today is for the federal government to develop more facilities like Metro Reentry Facility with federal grants and funding. Also, I would like to see the federal government develop more federal support of community-based partners willing to participate in programs like Metro Reentry Facility. I would just like to start out by saying it's been a great opportunity to be the first reentry facility here in Georgia. I have the opportunity to open this place up starting in 2018. We took in our first returning citizen May 1st of 2018. We are a 355-bed minimum security facility. We utilize evidence-based practices and community collaboration to reduce recidivism. We try to address the physical needs, social needs, intellectual, environmental, emotional, spiritual. Our target population here in Metro, we want to try to house guys that are minimum to medium security guys that we prefer them to have at least 12 to 24 months left on their sentences. And one of the things that we found out here in Georgia is that a large chunk of the prison population in Georgia is returning to the Metro Atlanta area. So we picked out the areas that that had the largest return rate of returning citizens coming back to those counties. And those counties that we are addressing, everybody here is returning to one of those counties. And those counties consist of Cobb, Clayton, DeKalb, Fulton, Gwinnett, Fayette, Henry, Rockdale, and Douglas. One of the real unique things that are best practices for Metro Reentry is what we did. We were able to start our program off from the ground up and brand new. So what we were able to do is we went in and trained all of our staff, meaning from food service to counselors to the maintenance staff to everybody. We made that part of the best practices, and what we did was train them in risk reduction classes so everybody could be on the same sheet of music when it came to creating a different type of an atmosphere for the returning citizen to participate in. We wanted to create something different than just regular prison here at Metro Reentry. All of the staff are trained in risk reduction, mental health, the new freedom curriculum, and 7 habits of highly effective people. Some of our correction officers here at Metro Reentry, we give them the opportunities when a counselor or something is not available. We let the correction officer conduct some of the programming here at Metro Reentry. That's some of the unique things that we do to try to keep everybody on the same sheet of music to keep the flow of the institution intact. Some of the unique things also that we do here at Metro Reentry that is kind of different and it's part of the best practices that we utilize mentors here at the facility. Our mentors create an atmosphere that is easier to work with for the returning citizens and for the staff. They are the go-betweens and they conduct a lot of our day-to-day activities. The mentors conduct groups. They also have open door policy to the staff. I talk to them on a regular basis. They keep me informed of everything that's going on within the facility, and that helps keep down on any kind of issues that you may have coming up. Anybody knows that if you're in prison, it's always a certain feeling that you get. One thing here at Metro Reentry, what we try to do is create a college-type atmosphere as opposed to an institutional-type atmosphere. And you've heard me call them returning citizens. That's one of the things that we've tried to do here is take the institutional feel away, and I call them inmates. We want to call them returning citizens. And that was developed by our former governor, and that was one of the names that he came up with, and it came into play, and it stuck, and it works well for us. We use a lot of family reunification things here at Metro Reentry to get our guys to get in better touch with their families and get that relationship back on track where they had damaged it early on. What we like to do is we use things such as we have things like One Day with God. We have a humongous family day where we invite the family out. They come out, we serve food. We have one of our volunteer churches provide all of the food and different things like that. And that helps keep the guys focused on what we're trying to get them to do here with all of the programming and different things like that. We have some outstanding things such as we use a little readers program for when they come to visitation. It's an organization that comes and they provide books and different things so the guys can sit with their kids and read to the kids, and that gives them a totally different experience rather than just sitting up and looking at each other. We also have an organization that works with us called Georgia Justice Project. It's a nonprofit organization, and they have really stepped up to the plate for us. They have helped us with legal issues with the guys. A lot of times you bring guys into these programs and you want them to leave here with a job, housing, and all those different things. But a lot of times they have a lot of lingering criminal justice things that are still still with them. So the Georgia Justice Project has partnered with us, and they are doing an outstanding job with helping these guys get past some of those legal hurdles that they have lingering. And they've been doing a great job with them. We also have we work with, I think you may have heard yesterday, with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and that is the Credible Messenger Program. We have that going with the ACES group. That targets gang members from a couple of certain counties here, and they address some of those specific needs and different things that they that those guys have. I would like to just close out and say today that Metro Reentry is a great program to help guys adjust back into society, and I think it would be a great thing if the federal government would, you know, contribute to some of these grants and stuff to help these programs along and foster some relationships with their some of their agencies to partner up and work along with a program like this. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Warden Perkins, for your informative testimony and certainly your service. Our last panelist today is Dr. H. Gene Wright II, who is the Director of Behavioral Health and Justice-Related Services at the Philadelphia Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Wright. You're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman Keith, and thank you to Vice Chair Sullivan and the commissioners that are on the line today. I want to start by just thanking my esteemed co-panelists. Mr. Johnson, really applaud the work that you're doing and respect the work you're doing there in Orlando. Commissioner Saunders and Warden Perkins, what you're doing in Georgia is amazing. And just wanted to acknowledge my fellow panelists and the great work that they're doing. The work that we're doing in Philadelphia is vast. Philadelphia is the fifth largest city in the nation currently, and we like to take an approach where we look at what Warden Perkins really said, which is how do we partner with community-based partnerships in the community. And so on behalf of the Commissioner of the Department of Behavioral Health, David T. Jones, I want to thank you for this opportunity. One of the things that Mr. Johnson and Mr. Saunders and Mr. Perkins hit on that really resonated with me is that the work that people are doing around the country to get the basic necessities for returning citizens to exit and returning to the community, and that, you know, driver's license, housing, all those things that we mentioned. Commissioner Perkins mentioned criminogenic needs and those kind of things. And so what I'd like to suggest for the commission today is that above and beyond what we normally do for reentry, which is all important, getting those identifications, getting resumes, getting training for jobs, I also would like to add that reentry goes beyond just getting those necessities. What we also need is reintegration. And so when I think of reentry, I partner that with reintegration because returning citizens and returning to the community, even if they have housing, if they have jobs, if they have resumes and IDs, it is not always enough to keep them grounded, connected, and anchored in the community. And so one of the things we're doing in Philadelphia is we really are looking at how we can partner with community organizations like the ones that I've suggested in my testimony, which you have my written testimony, so I won't go over that, but really just looking at what anchors individuals that are returning to the community. And what we've discovered is that what anchors individuals, besides having a job, besides having housing and all those necessities, is having a reintegration with their family. And so some of the programs that I've suggested and I'll talk about here in a minute or so is how do we reconnect returning citizens to their family. And so one of the main programs that I talked to you all about and wrote about in my written testimony, was one called Pennsylvania Back, which is Fathers and Children Together. And the reason I mentioned that program first is because we do not want to just address the individuals returning home or returning back to the community. We also want to keep young men and young women from going to prison or jail in the first place. Young men who grew up in homes without fathers are twice as likely to end up in jail as those who come from traditional two-parent homes. Those boys whose fathers were absent from their household had double the odds of being incarcerated. Even when other factors such as race, income, parent education, and urban residence were held constant, these individuals still, if there's no father in the home, those individuals at a higher risk of being incarcerated themselves. 40% of all children that do not live with their natural father, and the number is growing. Research repeatedly indicates that father neglect is the most significant factor towards delinquency and crime. Even with women, nationally there are 120,000 incarcerated mothers and 1.1 million incarcerated fathers who are parents of minor children. And so the program that I really spoke to you all about and wrote about is the Fathers and Children Together program, because when we connect or reconnect fathers returning to the community with their children, what happens is that father now takes on responsibility and they are now reintegrated into the community. They have an anchor. They have a motivation. They have a purpose to stay in the community and not to recidivate and go back to some of those playgrounds that Director Perkins was talking about. And so that's very, very important, is that we can reconnect individuals and not just help them reenter, but reintegrate them. And by reintegration, I'm talking about giving them an anchor. And so when I look at what's the most important part of being a father, it is training. And so we work with the prison system in Pennsylvania. And I noticed you had Secretary Wetzel on your panel yesterday, and so he has been an advocate of the Fathers and Children Together program in Pennsylvania. And so what we have been able to do over the past several years is look at the responses of men that are returning to the community and being reintegrated with family. As of yet, we have not been able to launch a pilot program or a similar program for returning women back to the community. So far, we have been focused on males. And so another program that we really look at that I think is important, and I think Warden Perkins touched on this in terms of utilizing the faith community. And so we have another program called Community Forgiveness and Restoration, where we recruit faith communities, be it churches and synagogues or masjids or mosques, and we partner with these faith leaders to adopt a returning citizen a year to 18 months before their release date. And we have life coaches that go inside the prison and work with these men. And when they come out, they are not looking for a support system. They already have one established. And they're able to do the same things that Mr. Johnson talked about. They're able to get their driver's license. They're able to get connected to resources in the community. But they're also able to connect to a faith-based organization that will walk with them, with certified peer specialists, with peers that have an understanding of what is needed. With both of these programs that I'm sharing with you today, we have the opportunity to connect those that have behavioral health challenges with clinical psychologists. My training is as a clinical and forensic psychologist, and so I'm able to connect these men with those type of services if they have drug and alcohol concerns or mental health concerns. We're also able to provide services and supports to the primary caregiver in the community, which is usually the mother, and meet her needs and the family's needs. We have aftercare programs for the children of incarcerated parents so that, again, it's not a one-direction, it's a bi-directional support system that we have, that we focus on the children of incarcerated parents. And if you look at my written document, you'll see that there are so many children of incarcerated parents that it's important that we're able to connect these men to their children and to their families so that they have that anchor that we spoke of. Moving quickly to my recommendations, we would like to have the commission look at support development of reentry programs that start behind the walls, that go beyond traditional training, vocational, resume building, and in addition to basic necessities like acquiring a driver's license, et cetera, which are all necessary and needed, but to also give these men some anchors by basically supporting the training and education that the people that I provide and deal with, we provide that educational training. Looking at motivational interviewing, looking at emotional intelligence, and giving that kind of training to these men that are returning. Create a task force whose function and purpose is to research, design, and recommend best practices for reentry/reintegration programs. This task force would consist of academicians, public servants, local grassroots organizations that we have mentioned before, those community connections, private foundations, certified peer specialists, individuals who have already reentered and are reintegrating in the community, provide funding to those organizations, and demonstrate the ability to implement successful programs, and those organizations support those that can reduce recidivism from these works. Improve the quality of life for the returning citizen. That also keeps them reintegrated in the community. Another recommendation, simplify grant applications for organizations that do great work but cannot afford the expense of a grant writer, and or provide enhanced technical assistance for those organizations who have been awarded a grant and would otherwise would not qualify for grant funding if not for invisible barriers. There's a lot of invisible barriers for some of these community-based organizations that are not able to complete these grant forms. And finally, utilize the current and prevailing research that identifies and describes the impact of social determinants. Example, poverty, unemployment, underemployment, food insecurity, over-incarceration. What are those impacts on children and families in the communities? And when we address these issues, again, then we are supporting men and women that are returning to the community to not just reenter, but to also reintegrate and to connect and to stay in the community and become citizens as they were before, or citizens in terms of contributing to the economy, contributing to the organizations and the communities that they come from, because as my esteemed panelist has said before me, 95 to or higher percent are returning to the community. And so what I would like to see is for us to support them in the other aspects of reintegration that go beyond just reentry. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Wright, for your informed testimony and certainly your service. Commissioners, we're now open for questions for the witnesses. Commissioners with a question, please state your name prior to your question and direct that question to a specific panelist, or if a response from the entire panel is your intent, please state so. Just as a reminder to the commissioners, your mics are hot at all times. Thank you, and now we'll entertain questions from commissioners for our panelists.
This is Katie. I have actually three questions, if you would allow.
Yes, ma'am, you're recognized.
Thank you. So my first one is to Commissioner Sanders. We've heard a lot in different contexts about having to change culture. We've heard that around officers' suicides and how officers deal with mental health. Can you give specific ways in which you believe that we can change culture? In this particular instance, it's around reentry and criminal justice. But what are some specific actual ways that we can change culture, in your opinion?
Well, one of the things we've seen in Georgia, and thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan, one of the things we've seen in Georgia is the use of a couple of different, we have what we call a multifunctional officer. That officer is, as Warden Perkins described, a highly trained officer who goes through a lot of the same programming that our counselors do, and they're also trained to teach the inmates and lead some of these programs, so that's been very helpful. We've done a lot of things such as motivational interviewing, and we look at, you know, our hiring practices, who we are hiring. That's one. Corrections, for so long, unfortunately, in any correctional system, it's easy to have that just lock them up and throw away the key mentality. But like I said, here in Georgia, we've over the last 6 or 8 years had realized these individuals are coming home, and they're going to live next door to you and I. Like I said, with the large number of individuals that we have on in the correctional system and under probation and parole supervision in Georgia, everybody knows someone who's been affected by the system. So the main thing with ours has been staff training, just continually training, educating the staff on how to help these individuals. I mean, we're trying to work ourselves out of a job, as it were, by the fact that we do not want to see these individuals coming back to us. So focusing on our staff and the various trainings that we give them as they interact with the individuals that are in our custody.
Great. Thank you so much. That's very helpful. We need to make concrete recommendations to the president, and as I've been reflecting on writing the report, and we can't just recommend to the president, hey, we should change the culture. We have to have some real deliverables on how to do that. So thank you very much for those concrete examples. Tim, how are you? Thank you so much. I should say Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for testifying. And I know that everybody wants to ask you if it was super fun to play in the NFL, but we cannot do that today. I want to hear about, and a little unfair advantage I have because I have met with Tim, and he's a wonderful, generous man. And you have also worked with the courts on how to pay back fees, fines, and costs. And you described that program to me a little bit. I would like to know how you created community relationships and, you know, you as a not-for-profit or as a private organization, how did you push in and create the relationship with the court so that they trusted you and you could have that you know, that exchange or that relationship?
Well, thank you, Vice Chair Sullivan. You are Jim. Appreciate all that you're doing on this subject. I will say, if I may, just even go back to Commissioner Sanders, the amazing things that he shared. Changing the culture will be added to what you just asked me about how we did it, because in 2014, just to take you back, I'm a pastor, but I tell people I'm not strange. So, you know, a lot of times religious figures get treated a little bit differently. So I always wanted to live outside of the box. One of the things that I did 2 years after getting to Orlando from Nashville, I walked into the city of Orlando mayor's office, and I said, listen, we're a small congregation. We just, you know, have a few hundred people. Can we serve you in any way? We have 13,000 hours of service. Tell us what to do. And one of his executives that I've been here 20 years and I've never had a church come and give us something. And so I always wanted to have a different paradigm and be somewhat of a disruption in how we are perceived in the community. So starting with that, I have had a history of serving in many ways throughout the city of Orlando. So in 2014, I go to my friends at corporations. Universal Studios and Hilton Organization and PepsiCo and all these different organizations and say, hey, guys, I have a wild idea. I think we can bring thousands of people into the stadium in Orlando and serve them in basic ways to overcome the barriers that they are hindered by on a regular basis. If you're a single mom with three babies and you had a crack issue, it's going to be hard to get the Social Security office appointment. It's going to be hard to go over and take care. So it takes months to get past certain barriers. So we wanted to bring everything together in the stadium to do that, which we did in 2016 and 17. So all my friends that were in the corporate world, we went from their built teams, business owners, CEOs, executives, and then we went to the office of the mayor and the county mayor and the city mayor. And said, listen, we want to develop with you. And then we went to the faith community. I always wanted people to know I don't have an agenda. So on Easter morning 2016, we had 52 bus stops, 100 buses that drove 4,000 miles, and I canceled my Easter service, which you never do as a pastor. It's a huge sacrifice. I had laid down a lot of groundwork for my intentions to see a community healed and restored and hope brought back in practical ways. So we had 120 organizations that worked together over those couple of years, really since 2014 and beyond. When we did that, we eventually found out that there was a pressing need for our legal services. So I had a whole legal arm. We had health and wellness. We had jobs and education and a lot of different areas. So this legal one, really, we started to get bombarded, honestly. I have a relationship with Chief Judge Lott, who has retired, and now with Chief Judge Myers. So we had already relationship with what we were doing when he got up. They saw the credibility of what we're doing. They saw the sacrifice. They saw the way we gave and how much integrity we carried ourselves with. So that when we started to get pressed with the needs for the legal issues, it was easy to go to Judge Lawton and say, Chief Judge, we had the Clerk of Courts, we have Robert Wesley, the Public Defender's Office, we had Aramis Ayala, State Attorney's Office, all in partnership because of our relationship with Chief Judge Lawton, again, who's retired. We started to build out what it would look like to handle the needs we were being confronted with. We would have an event, and months later, we would still get phone calls. So we started to build out. In 2016, we had our first He Got Up Court. We had hundreds of people come in, and we prepared the cases through Family Law School, private law attorneys, Barry Law School, and many other volunteers, Legal Aid Society. So we had been working through the initial relationship of a macro event that was changing the culture, because you had rich people working with poor people. You had ex-cons working with atheists. You had all this, the community together was pretty dynamic, and that began to show us how much we are better together. And through those means, we started to get more specific, and the relationships were there through the course of working on all the other initiatives.
It's so great, the public-private partnership and starting there and then ground up, seeing the need and then having the resources. That's incredible. Thank you so much, and thank you for your testimony. Dr. Wright,
thank you.
I have one. I have a lot of questions about the parenting and working with the family law courts and things like that, but I think I'm just going to focus my question on, you talk about barriers to receiving grants. For some smaller community-based organizations, can you give us any specificity about what those barriers are? That could be very helpful.
Yes, thank you again, Vice Chair Sullivan. What I have discovered in these, really trying to set up these community partnerships, these community-based partnerships, is that as we went in, and the Department of Behavioral Health, with the generosity of our commissioner, David T. Jones, is able to give small grants to some of these grassroots organizations or community-based partnerships, partnerships like $5,000 or something like that. We've also been able to sponsor events where we go in and we help those organizations with their advertising, or we help them when they put on a workshop or a symposium or something like that. What I discovered in working with these groups is that they have a greater need, and they're doing great work with very little money, but they do not have grant writers, and they do not have anybody on their staff that has the expertise or the capability of navigating sometimes the very complex federal grants that are out there. And then I discovered in terms of the state grants, or what people call block grants, depending on where you are, and those grants may be easier to fill out or complete, but they really rely upon a relationship with, you know, the state representatives and the state senators in the capital, whatever state you happen to be in this case, Pennsylvania and Harrisburg. And so if you do not have a relationship where they know who you are and they know what your organization is about, and you do not have an inroad into contacting them, those grants are difficult to get as well. So the invisible barriers go from not having grant writing expertise to not having the relationships or the connections to get some of those state funds. And so that's what I found in the two groups that I've worked with, the Fathers and Children Together program and also the Community Forgiveness and Restoration program, just two examples.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from commissioners?
Chairman Keith, this is David Ralph.
Yes, sir, you're recognized.
Thank you. On the same line on funding, we've heard from a lot of different folks, and funding seems to be something that is clearly needed. However, I think, as we all know, especially as a result of the current condition we're in, funding may be difficult going forward, at least, you know, for the next year or two because of the situation we're in. But my question is, with the funding that will be provided or available, is there a way of maybe seeding activities or seeding these types of programs with a shown ability to sustain them with savings that are realized in these areas. And so I'd be curious to hear if that's a possibility of being able to show what the savings could be used to do. Are there real savings that will be experienced with these types of programs that could be put back into the program, therefore not needing continuous funding, but a seed?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to respond to that. This is Dr. Wright.
Yes, sir, Dr. Wright, you're recognized.
Thank you. The example I would like to give really goes back to 2010, where we, in Philadelphia, we were at the time working on lots of grants, one of which was the Crisis Intervention Training Grant for our law enforcement in partnership with the Behavioral Health System. And we've had a BJA grant, Bureau of Justice grant since then, and other type grants. And what we've been able to do in Philadelphia is once we've been able to utilize the grant funding, we have been able to sustain many, if not all, of those programs and initiatives that started with a grant. And so the short answer to your question, Commissioner, is yes. If seed money were available, and we would be able to show savings, number one, in terms of keeping people out of the justice system, and those numbers are easy to come up with, but also the quality of life piece that is more difficult to quantify, but certainly we can document. And when you think about people not returning to jail and working in jobs that where they pay taxes and being reconnected with families. And so when we see that, and then that, of course, keeps people from going to prison in the first place, we break that intergenerational cycle of incarceration, which is not just a savings in money, but a savings in people. And so to me, in Philadelphia, we've been able to demonstrate over time that receiving grant funding, we are able to sustain those programs or those initiatives so that it is not a continuous and a forever supplement from the government.
Mr. Chair, this is Jay Sanders. I'd like to also say just a word on that if I could.
Yes, you're recognized.
Thanks, sir. I've got to agree with Mr. Johnson and Dr. Wright. I'm an old probation officer. I started 25-plus years ago in a rural part of Georgia, and we need I'll speak for Georgia and other states. A lot of times, I mean, it's easy for us to pull resources together in metro areas. Where we really run into problems is when we get out into the rural areas. And so any ability to fund some of these grassroots nonprofits that are out here getting the job done, especially in rural areas, would be very helpful. And that, as Dr. Wright said, would prevent them from ever coming to prison in the first place. And so we've reduced recidivism. And I know in Georgia it costs $20,000 to $22,000 a year to house someone. So those are some savings that we would realize if we could keep them out of the system to start with. So they just need options. Judges need options. Community-based options, many times other than just a prison option for folks that are struggling with mental health and substance abuse. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to add a thought, if I may.
Yes, sir, you're recognized. Yes, sir.
One quick thought for us. I agree with the panelists on actually being, it would be easy to quantify the effects of funding and reducing costs on the community, the moral cost, relational cost. But for our situation, we're a small organization, and we've seen in 4 years almost $2 million in fines, fees, and court costs reduced to a payment plan or community service. And we've not received any grant funding. We just didn't have, like Dr. Wright said, the horsepower, the capacity, grant writers. I just recently been introduced to the process of even having a chance to do it. And so we've seen a huge impact in our community of Orlando, and a lot of it was because of my professional sports background. I would just build relationships and do golf tournaments and just, we would just grind out. It was $1.5 million to do our first 2 year events because we did it in a football stadium and it was over $900,000 in kind committed to that, $400,000, $500,000 in cash. Now our program is like $13,000, $15,000 a year because we are so heavily weighted on volunteers and everyone trusts us in this city. The only challenge for us is the only way to really get going and accelerate to be a sustainable operation, we would need funding to do that. So we're way down the road. Funding wouldn't just be a seed. It would be an accelerator for us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Other commissioners with questions? One final time. Other commissioners with questions? Hearing no further questions, let me close by thanking our panelists once again for your time and most valuable testimony and responses to the questions from our commissioners. On behalf of the Attorney General and his leadership team of Rachel Bissick and Jeff Vita and all the commissioners, your contributions provided today are sincerely appreciated and will assist the commission in their deliberations and work. Before we close, just a reminder, our last hearing this week is tomorrow, and we'll focus on criminal justice and grants and processes. This last series of questions will be a great segue into that discussion. Also, please check the President's Commission page for additional updates of documents and information on the Maine Justice website, and we will update it regularly when information is available for posting. Are there any questions or comments from commissioners? If there's no further business before us today, the President's Commission is adjourned, and thank you again, commissioners, for your continued dedication and commitment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and all the presenters.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all
so much.
Thank you
very much. This conference is now concluded. You may disconnect your phone lines.